Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now,
now's the time to do the right thing.
Yeah. Hey, Facebook folks, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are having a time this morning. We are not only live, but we are having a brother from inside Missouri prisons, and they decided they wanted to have a lockdown. So we got plenty of problems this morning. So please, please, please bear with us. I don't know. We kind of got it muffled. I'm going to have the phone right up to the ear. This may not work. Say something, Frederico.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Okay. I'm going to try to do less talking because mine does a echo sound. So if you got the promotion about today's show, we were going to be talking about wrongful convictions, and particularly in Missouri. And in one case we wanted to focus on is Frederico Lobe. And this is a brother that's been in prison for nearly 40 years, not for murder. This is for a alleged rape. And so will you talk about all of the factors that get people off, like somebody admitting that they lied or that they were coerced? Those situations are not part of this case, and so it's made it very, very difficult. But we feel like there's compelling evidence that the circuit attorney has, including DNA, that we need to get this case resolved. And Frederico Lobe is in one of Missouri's prisons, and I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about his case. It's a case that the Organization for Black Struggle has been working on for decades now. We got file boxes on this case like none other. But yeah, so it's somebody that's been fighting diligently, persistently, for pursuit of justice that ultimately will lead to his freedom. So, Frederico, I'm going to stop talking so we don't get a feedback and let you tell a little bit about the case.
Okay. Yeah, good morning, everybody. My name is Frederico Lobe. Everybody call me C. But anyway, I was convicted in a 1988 rape of a South St. Louis lady who claimed that and two other guys raped her after she had a fight with her boyfriend. The boyfriend left and went in the house and didn't come back out. And so she decided to walk home. And as she said she was walking home, she said three guys pulled up alongside of her in a blue or either green car. And at the time, one of the guys asked, did she want to ride home? And she said that she told the guys, no, she did not want to ride home. And as a direct result, they went down the street, made a U-turn, came back, and was supposed to have drug her in the alley, from what I'm reading from the police report. And as a direct result of that, that's when they were supposed to have committed the rape on her. After she was raped and the guy left her in the alley, she got up and ran out of the alley. And it was two bystanders that were supposed to go in their house at the time. It happened on Spring and Folsom in the city of St. Louis and South St. Louis. And as they were going out, they noticed that she was walking down the street, and they asked her, did she need some help? She said she needed help. And We all went to call the police. Police showed up. Just so happened, it was two police officers that I had prior indications with dealing with. They gave me some false drug charges that I ended up getting found not guilty of in the St. Louis Circuit Court. They took the man to the hospital, and as a direct result, the doctor performed the root kit on her and prepared the evidence and presented the evidence to the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office. After he presented it to the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office, the evidence was turned over to criminologist Joe Crow. When Joe Crow examined the evidence that he received from the doctor, the evidence had been that the victim said that she had not had sex for 2 weeks prior to the rape happening. Also, that she had not cleaned herself after the rape. So as a direct result, the criminalist Joe Crow actually knew he had this evidence in his possession. He said he did not conduct any testing on the sperm that they found in her vagina due to the fact that he said it was a small amount. So he didn't want to run no test of making a false positive or a false negative test. So therefore, he decided not to run the test. At this time, I arrested the rape after they say she gave my name as the individual who committed the rape. And I was arrested and put in the lineup. And as a direct result, they claimed that she picked my photograph out of the lineup that they presented her, the photo lineup that they presented her with. And then in the physical lineup, they say she identified me as the individual that actually did the rape. They still not identified the other two guys. Nevertheless, here it is. While I'm being charged, they give us some documents that Joe Crow had, which were what the police report and the medical reports. They give us the document, and the documents that they give us, you couldn't see any of the evidence at all. And the evidence that we could not see was the evidence that I just spoke about briefly. She had physical sperm in the vagina that they did not want us to know about. So as a direct result of that, they hid this evidence from us all the way during my trial. While we were going through the trial, we couldn't put any defense due to the fact that if we had this medical report to show that she hadn't had sex for 2 weeks prior to the rape act, we could have used it to my defense. As a direct result of that, by them hiding this evidence, this is what the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office normally does when they have a case that they want to win on a false basis. So by them not giving us the evidence, I went through the trial, and they did not allow me the opportunity that I should have been given to contest her testimony according to my confrontational rights of the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Nevertheless, she came into the courtroom and identified me and said that I was the individual that raped her. And the jury came back with guilty verdicts and found me guilty of raping this victim. So we went through the appeal and the appeal process. The appeal was denied due to the fact that they said that the state did not make any errors during my time of me being arrested. And therefore, in my trial, there was no error violation. Moving forward, me having knowledge of the DNA evidence, I took the DNA evidence upon myself to challenge it due to the fact that after I did my studies and my research, and DNA actually came out that helped individuals get released from prison, I petitioned the court for a DNA hearing so that I could have the DNA tested. The court has been about testing the DNA because the circuit attorney's office down there that was manned by Charles Speech, a.k.a. Larry Johnson. They put a fight saying that I didn't have appropriate evidence to challenge the evidence that they used against me. So as a direct result of that, the district ruled in my favor that I should have the DNA testing conducted on the evidence when I pointed out my victims, one of my alleged victims, And based on her testimony that she gave in September 15, 1988 deposition, that she did not know if her rapist ejaculated in her vagina or not. She said he could have. So I used that as a momentum to put to court to allow me to have the DNA tested due to the fact that the DNA did not come from me. And so when I proved that the evidence was not met, after we ran the DNA testing and the judge granted the testing process, they changed it not to match me. The prosecutor then screamed that the evidence belonged to the victim's boyfriend. I'm not being honest to anybody. My boyfriend was in the courtroom right next to where the court where we were at. And we contacted a boyfriend and asked him to give us a pillow swab so that we can run the test and make a determination whether or not the DNA belonged to him as the state asserted. Come find out the DNA did not belong to him either. So we took the opportunity and let down just a little bit so that we can get our feet up on the ground, back on the ground. So once the DNA did match the black man, the DNA didn't match me. The judge, we forced the judge to bring the victim back into the room. And he said, I record, I don't DNA does not match me, but that DNA does not match her also. So the judge instructed the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office to find the victim. She was hiding in a drug house at this time. And she did not want to be contacted by anybody. But they found her. They sent some a string of cops out to go look for her. And they found her. And they put her in the courtroom. And they questioned her about the evidence, the DNA evidence not belonging to me or her boyfriend. And asked her who did the DNA belong to. So during the time of the DNA hearing, she came out and testified that she had sex with several individuals. Something that they knew she had right before the rape even happened. And as a direct result of that, she testified that she had sex with a guy named Fred Knox. Now, I remind you, Fred Knox was one of my close associates at that time. And at the time, he had been distant. And I'm figuring that she gave the name Fred Knox because Fred was dead. And so at that opportunity, she asked her, did she know that Fred Knox was dead? And she said, yes, I knew he was dead at the time. And she allowed her to go on and continue to speak about whether or not her and Fred Knox actually had sex.
So, Frederico, I'm going to stop you right there to do a little recap, because you did a lot. And I don't know, I want to make sure people can hear you. But right now, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are talking to Frederico Lobe, a.k.a. Sheik, who was falsely accused of a rape in 1988. So he's been in prison since then, struggling to bring the facts of the case, which has been very difficult because there were two police officers who made it clear that they had it out for him because they had falsely accused him of drugs. And he won that case successfully in court, which then heightened their revenge on him. So this is the theory that we have, and we meaning myself, Frederico, but I also want to let you know that we have had assistance from Centurion Ministries. And if that name sounds familiar, that is the same organization who deals with wrongful conviction when we were dealing with the Ellen Reasonover case, and she was released in 1999. So they have been active in cases across the country, but they have been successful in several releases of men and women here in St. Louis. So, and I'm going to have Frederico give you the name of those two officers. I know one of them is Heyman. I can't remember the other one. But these folks then chose this particular woman who was vulnerable to being accosted by the police because she was not only had an addiction to crack cocaine, but she was prostituting to get money for her habit. So this is the nature of the mid-80s, if you can remember, when the crack cocaine epidemic was wild and alive and ravaging our communities. I call it a biological warfare. So here's this victim who's vulnerable, who gets chosen, selected by the circuit attorney's office in collaboration with the police. So she went to her grave, an early grave, I might add, still holding on to this, pointing out Frederico as the person. But as Frederico has outlined, her story changed many times as the facts came to light. And so I just want people to know that if that trial had happened in 2025, Frederico would have been acquitted, because the facts just didn't add up. There was no credible witnesses. So what we have been advocating for is a new trial or a complete release of this brother from the cages of Missouri. So some people may know about this case. I would say that Frederico on his own pretty much has been the marketer and communicator around this case to various media outlets. And recently the case got the attention of Matt Woods, who's with KMOX TV, who's doing a series on his podcast about Frederico's case. And so that's where we are. So Frederico, I just want to ask you about what kind of support were you getting from your family? Because when Matt interviewed me, I talked about the number of cases that OBS was a part of, or even the many letters that we get asking for help. And what we found out is that you have to have a really almost obsessive defendant with some support from family to keep the pursuit of justice active. But what we found out is if people get too overloaded and overwhelmed, they give up. They give up because it's just hard to go against the system. It's like pushing up against a brick wall. So when we say that the number of wrongfully convicted is way more than what's coming to the fore, I'm thinking about those brothers and sisters who just gave up and just say, I'll just do my time because it looks like I'm not going to get any support. It's only so much Centurio Ministries can do, or an Innocence Project, because these cases are very expensive. They range from $500,000 to $250,000 to do the research, to find witnesses, to do DNA tests, to bring in specialists. It costs a lot of money. So even when people contact Centurio Ministries or Innocence Project, they're going to be put on a waiting list. And so my disgust with the system is that once you find out somebody is innocent, not just procedurally innocent, it is the responsibility of the circuit attorney's office, in this case, this is the prosecutor, to deal with that case in a expeditious way. And we don't find that that's what's been the case. So talk a little bit about that, what is meant to get the even the attention of the circuit attorney to deal with this case, and what support you've had.
Well, we want to keep in mind that, you know, my family has been very supportive of me from day one, because, you know, growing up, I'm a Golden Glove boxer. I fought out for the Park Recreation Center. I'm from the Sphinx Boys. And as a result, I had a nice reputation of as a youngster growing up in the city of St. Louis. And, I'm known throughout the city. No matter where I go, I'm known. But my family has been very, very supportive of me. And, you know, when certain crimes happen with a family member knows when an individual is being lied on and when an individual is not being lied on. And my family has been on my side from forever. You know, no matter what, you know, they knew I couldn't have possibly beat this. Now, this situation stemmed out of that St. Louis Southern Attorney's Office. The St. Louis Southern Attorney, which we talking about, George Peach, a.k.a. Larry Johnson.
Right.
When George Peach had the opportunity to prosecute me because I had gotten away from the drug charges that they gave me, these same officers, Ruben Haven and James Long.
There you go. Say those names again.
Ruben Haven and James Long.
Mm-hmm.
In my interview with Matt Woods as well. And Haven was the one that went on TV and explained that because the victim said that I did this, or that meant that the jury found me guilty of all of the evidence, therefore I was guilty. Later that they thought I was speaking about this George Peach character. Because George Peach, man, he was a mess. He was terrible, and everybody in St. Louis knows George Peach when it come down to so-called Negro, Black, and colored people. He makes it his business to put us in prison no matter what. You know, he don't care what it is. He of course, you're in the prison. If you go to trial and the judge is down in St. Louis Circuit Court, they're going to find you guilty, and they're going to hang you. So this is one of the bottom line topics about George Peach in that office. But then the Jones and George Hayes, they were no better. Because under each one of them, George Peach. George Peach was the one I had in contact to clarify the medical report that they gave my attorney at trial. They gave us an electoral medical report where we couldn't see any of the evidence. So this was the tactic that they used against me. In gaining this illegal conviction, because had I had that medical report that Cole had prior to getting to the prosecutor that prosecuted me, which was Marianne L. Miller, that I would have used that evidence, I would have walked out of court on a free man.
Yeah.
How great earth would this woman have ever stepped in that courtroom and said that I raped her, and that DNA proved that I was the one that raped her when she had sex for 2 weeks prior to the rape happened, and she did not clean herself after she was raped. But she was taken to the hospital, and the doctor examined her, and then compiled a written and sent it on down to the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office.
So what we have, Frederico, we have evidence that the DNA did not belong to you, and that the victim was not credible in that she changed her story several times. She changed even who the perpetrator was several times. And so to me, this is enough for the circuit attorney's office, whether it be Gabe Gore, or even those before him, to say, wait a minute, let's take a second look at this, because the two things that got you convicted was just that. The witness, and so if those are no longer credible, then you have to say we need to look at this case again. I will have let people know, our listeners know, that this case was presented to Kim Gardner at the time that she came into office, but as you well know, Kim Gardner couldn't even look at a lot of these cases because she was defending her own reputation, which was being attacked by the white power structure here in St. Louis. And so we met with her several times, right? And she was interested, but she could not get the momentum going around her. But before she left, she did deal with Lamar Johnson's case. And so there are many, many folks, you know, just a shout out to Lamar Johnson, to Chris Dunn, a number of the brothers and sisters that have been victimized by the so-called justice system, we thought we were getting a reform prosecutor when we got Kim Gardner, but she was literally forced out of that office. And so here we are with a new person. So this is about the fourth or fifth prosecutor that we've been presenting this case to, and what we have found, and this is not just Frederico's case, but what we have found is once a prosecutor has convicted, they all rally around and continue to support the conviction. Even when it's appealed, they will say, we uphold the lower court's you know, conviction. And so it's very, very hard to break that cycle. And that's where we are now, right now. And so what kind of publicity have you been able to get, Frederica, around this case? Because I think people want to know what they can do to support you. And I know you talked about you really wanted people to call Gabe Gore's office, who's the current circuit attorney, to see about putting some pressure on him to take a look at this case and get it resolved.
We need to have our callers call Gabe Gore at 314-622-4941 due to the fact that the DNA evidence does not match me. And the identification, the victim said she remembered me when the judge asked her. After she knew he was Frank Kiko, she said, oh, I remember him. I remember him from Natty. He was light-skinned and had freckles all over his face. Well, that's not Frederico. Frederico doesn't have any freckles on his face at all. And as a direct result, nobody even questioned whether or not I had freckles in the court or in the DNA hearing or anywhere else.
They weren't interested in that.
No, they wasn't. They weren't interested in any of it. All I was concerned with was me being blocked up due to the fact that she said I'm the one that did it. And backed off of the policeman, Heyman, woman Heyman and James Long, said that she called and gave my name as a person. When she said, Phil, unidentified black males did this. She called and gave my name as the person that did this, sir. And they took the photograph to her house and let her review the photographs, and she all of a sudden picked me out. But yeah, but in the most important, to suppress the identification prior to the trial story, when my lawyer asked her, say, well, didn't you give us the name of the man that made you? Didn't you say Frederico was that man? She said, I didn't say of him. I said, I gave you the name of the person that they knocked up, which was Frederico. He said, but didn't you say Frederico was the one that raped your sodomized? She said, I didn't say of him. I did not say that.
So again, we have conflicting, you know, testimony from somebody who was able to lie for whatever reason and get a conviction that has stood fast for the last, 38 years. And so I want people to really understand that, for example, and I told this to Gabe Gore when we met with him, that you have been in prison longer than some people who have been convicted of murder. And that's a natural born truth. And so what is it about this case that we can't get some kind of breakthrough when if the magic bullet is DNA and your DNA did not match? Why are you still in prison is the question I constantly get asked. Why are you still in prison if that was what was supposed to exonerate you?
The reason why I'm still in prison, they keep saying that the victim said that the rapist didn't ejaculate in her vagina. Therefore, there's no type of support that I'm actually innocent, right? But we took a deposition on September 15th, 1988. When she testified specifically, and this is what I don't understand. The Missouri Court of Appeal, the St. Louis Circuit Court, and the sole judges down in St. Louis Circuit Court, nobody pays attention. The deposition is a sworn on oath document, Jamala. You know, and in the document, she said prior to the trial ever start, in the sworn on oath document, it says, She did not know if her rapist ejaculated in her vagina. I used that evidence right there to show that what the state was saying was inaccurate and that I was entitled to DNA. So by me using that, the judge went on and granted my DNA testing based off of that evidence there. But afterwards, the Missouri Court of Appeals reported that the victim said he didn't ejaculate. The second attorney's office is screaming that one of the victims says he didn't ejaculate, therefore the DNA evidence don't matter no more. The DNA does matter because if she hadn't had sex for 2 weeks prior to the rape happening, when she was examined at the hospital after the rape, and she had not had sex for them 2 weeks prior to that rape happening, and she did not clean herself, that's what belongs to that actual evidence. She could not have had sex with anybody else in that race.
And so my point, I think my point still stands, Frederico, that regardless of whether there was an ejaculation or not, the DNA is still a credible tool in your case. So if she says there was no ejaculation, then why did you get convicted? And then if she says there was, then you got DNA to say that's not your DNA. So again, this is something that we believe that the prosecutor attorneys office needs to sort through quickly. They've had the case under review for a while, and let's get to some decisive decisions about what's going to happen with you in your life. I mean, you missed a whole bunch of stuff. You missed your mother died during this time. You've had births. You've had grandkids. Yeah, all of this, birthdays, graduations, you missed it all. And so, I always try to get listeners to understand what it means when you get incarcerated for decades, disconnected from family support, disconnected from a whole world. Yeah, for a crime that you didn't do, but you.
We have to ask the people.
Because the fight is escalating. I think the fact that for example, the I think it's 6 series that Matt Woods did that really interviews all the folks who were a part of this, that gives people a really good sense of what happened and who made it happen. And so to me, it's quite revealing that there was an injustice that's been done, and that needs to be corrected. And it needs to be corrected really, really fast, because you've already, like I said, almost 38 years in prison. That is unconscionable. And that is a time that you can never recover. You can't get that back. You can't. So,
I'm not saying I was angry, but I ain't no racist either.
Well, I think that's appropriate for you to... No, I get that.
You hear me?
Yeah, yeah. But here's the thing, though, Frederico. No, here's the thing, that what often happens, and I hear this from people, when somebody says, I'm innocent, then people will say, who don't do this kind of work, well, they all say that, but they really don't. You're admitting now that you weren't an angel back in 1985, but you didn't do this. I mean, it's the same thing that Bobby Bostic said. He said, I'm not saying I'm innocent. I did what I got convicted of. And he also called himself a young knucklehead. So he's never, wavered away from that. But what he said was 99 years for what I did is unfair and unjust. Instead about trying to really deal with that. So what I'm trying to get people to understand is rarely is there a time when somebody says that they were innocent and weren't. The people that I know who did the crime admit it, but don't believe that they should be held in prison under unjust conditions, under unfair conditions, under unhealthy conditions, under unsafe conditions. And this is what the fight is about. But I think that's part of the same fight. But for people who were wrongfully convicted, we have an obligation as citizens who are paying taxes. That office doesn't exist without us paying taxes. We shouldn't have our money spent in that way, that we are convicting people just because somebody's got a vendetta out and other courts continue upholding the injustice. That's not what we are trying to create. And I ask people to remember, what if you were wrongfully convicted? What kind of justice system would you want in place to make sure that was corrected?
Right. the most crazy thing in this whole situation is, tell me that when walking the streets on the 1980s, that I got found out you didn't throw it off. They did not like that.
Yeah.
Who would have been the James Long? They told me that you ain't gonna walk the streets this summer. You know, they told me I wasn't gonna walk the streets this summer of 1980. I didn't walk the streets this summer of 1980. No one would tell me.
Right, right. So they knew exactly what they were doing.
And see, this is why I was pushed to have Gabe Gore to actually look at this case for what he needs to look at the case for, because in actuality, it's a straight up setup and payback. You know what I'm saying? It's retaliation because I found that kid that was fluid charge. You know?
Yeah. But I also want people to understand that, particularly now with what Trump is doing, militarizing the police more, intensifying that, having our cities be under occupation, that means any one of us could be wrongfully arrested, wrongfully convicted, and wrongfully incarcerated. So again, this is a citizen issue to make the Circuit Attorney's Office accountable to us as citizens, taxpaying citizens, because if somebody now, and I'm not even talking about immigrants or people who come into the country without papers, I'm talking about folks who live here, and some of them have been snatched up by ICE, and they had to try to prove their citizenship. Well, it's the same thing with wrongful convictions. The onus then becomes on you to prove that you weren't guilty. And it shouldn't be that way. You're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And so that has not been the case for Black people or brown people in this country.
Right.
So what's our next steps?
Our next step is to get around Mr. Gore's bill and make him look at this evidence for what it was, because I'm going to tell you something. If my case had been a cold case, if this evidence would have been recovered in a cold case tomorrow, they could have took that evidence and used that evidence to say, yeah, you committed that case a long time ago because your DNA was found there. But here it is in my case, they don't even know who the evidence belongs to.
Right, right.
They refuse to put the evidence in the FBI and the coldest FBI computer to run the DNA to match up with any other individual. So I have to sit in prison because of the master description. The DNA ain't bad, but I've been convicted. We have to beat Gabe Brown's door down and demand, man, he released me immediately, man. I have to be released immediately. Because there ain't no such thing as a new trial. My victim is dead. And you know what? As much as I really, really enjoy hearing how it is that I changed him up, I honestly, down the hall, feel sorry for this sister. I really do. Because you know what? She didn't deserve this.
Yeah. Yeah,
she did not deserve it,
Jamal. She was a pawn. She was a pawn in this whole situation.
Yeah. And you know what? And I said, if I'm able to keep whatever money I can get when I get out of being substantiate myself in financial matters, man, that child that she had, man, I would make sure that child had some type of financial support for his life. I don't give a damn how old he is, man, because we owe that to this sister, man. We owe that to this sister. You know, our women are our backbone in society, man. Always have been and always will be. I don't know why people be out there doing the thing that they be doing to the sisters like that. There's a lot of times, man, but, you know, I struggle with these, Jamal, that she do not deserve this, what they gave to her. And that officer that ran by George Peace, who locked Larry Johnson up, and then turned around and used Larry Johnson's name.
Yeah.
As a person who was pushed to the from some undercover cops. And that's how he got thrown out
Yep. Some people might not be old enough to remember that. Exactly. That's right. But you know what Barry Sheck said of the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office, that they were the worst ones in terms of cooperating with DNA. They were paying for the DNA. They were paying just like Centurion Ministry paid for your DNA testing. But they don't. They blocked it, blocked it, blocked it, blocked it.
Yeah. So, you know,
if they continue this particular practice, this is not what they're supposed to do. This. They,